Welcome to The World Today. I'm Thomas Ariti. This Friday, Malcolm Turnbull confirms Australia's supporting the Philippines in fighting Islamic State and the anniversary of a World War II event, which marked a turning point in the fight against Japan.
1942 was the darkest year of the Second World War. Much had gone wrong. Singapore had fallen to great shock. Darwin had been attacked. Sydney Harbour had been attacked. Milne Bay was one of the first decisive defeats of the Japanese on ground.
But first, Australia Post has revealed that its former chief executive, Ahmed Fahour, was paid a total of $10.8 million after quitting earlier this year, amid political and community uproar about his fat pay deal. In its remuneration report released this morning, Australia Post confirmed Mr. Fahour was paid a total of $6.8 million in the 2017 financial year, sweetened by an additional $4 million in long-term incentives awarded from 2015 and 2016. Mr. Fahour's farewell pay is well above the $5.6 million estimate circulating in February in the lead-up to his abrupt resignation in the face of criticism. The Australia Post chairman, John Stanhope, has defended the multi-million dollar pay deal, but concedes it no longer meets community standards and is unlikely to pass the pub test. John Stanhope spoke with the ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
Well, John Stanhope, how difficult is it to justify a $10.8 million final payday for Ahmed Fahour?
Well, firstly, let's understand that what we're looking at there is obviously the amount of money that he would normally get paid in the year he worked, and then the rest of it is incentives and historicals. When you think about what he's done, it's fairly significant, from $300 million losses to the result that we're announcing today, $126 million profit.
Still, even though this includes Mr. Fahour's 2017 pay and long-term incentives over 3 years, it's still a pretty good farewell present given his torrid time at Australia Post over 7 years.
Well, you call it a torrid time. I would call it a significant time of contribution and actually bringing Australia Post back to paying dividends to the government, and so the taxpayers are getting a reward for that hard effort.
Mr. Stanhope, you took a lot of heat back in February about Mr. Fahour's salary from the Prime Minister and the Communications Minister in a hostile Senate committee. When the figure of Mr. Fahour's salary was sitting at around $5.6 million, now with bonuses it's doubled. So are you expecting a bigger community and political backlash?
I mean, if you're talking about does it meet today's community expectations, I think it's fair to say that community expectations have changed and that we recognise that, but we need to understand that when this CEO, the former CEO's contract was formed back in 2010, community expectations were different.
You talk about community standards, but at $10.8 million, does this pass the pub test?
Well, I've already said I don't believe that today's community expectations are met by that amount of money, but I do honour contractual obligations. And the recognition that we believe that doesn't pass the pub test is what we're doing going forward.
But did the board consider cutting Mr. Fahour's bonuses or maybe even taking them down to zero because of the potential for community or political flak?
A board under a contract doesn't have unfettered discretion. But in terms of contractual obligations, if hurdles are set down and conditions for payment are set down contractually, as they were, then we don't have an unfettered discretion to say we're not going to pay you anything.
Have you briefed either the Prime Minister or the Communications Minister given the hot issue of Mr. Fahour's ultimate pay?
Oh, of course. We have briefed the Prime Minister and the Minister about what is being released today, but certainly the Minister for Communications has indicated again to the board to take into account community expectations, and I've said we will, but we also have an obligation contractually to the employer.
Mr. Fahour's successor, Christine Holgate, will receive a substantially lighter deal set at a maximum of $2.75 million with a base fixed at 1.37 and a potential short-term bonus capped at a similar level. Do you accept, though, that that smacks of a bit of a raw deal, given moves to bridge the gender gap?
Look, it's got nothing to do with gender, what Christine Holgate's getting, and I'll point out that that remuneration for the new CEO has been set by the Remuneration Tribunal, not the board. But nevertheless, it is a adjustment for community expectations. I'm very pleased to have Christine Holgate accept this role on those conditions, and I think she'll be an excellent CEO.
Also, unlike Mr. Fahour, Ms. Holgate won't be eligible for long-term incentive payments like the ones that delivered Ahmed Fahour $4 million over 3 years.
No, again, part of the Remuneration Tribunal's conditions is there is or will not be a long-term incentive plan.
Do you have any regrets about the way Mr. Fahour's pay deal has been handled and seen by politicians and the public, given, as you say, the turnaround that he's undertaken at Australia Post?
My understanding is that the board at the time wrote a contract to persuade Mr. Fahour, who is an excellent CEO, to come and do the job, and community expectations were quite different back then. I understand why they did that, and they attracted him and his talent, and I still will maintain that he's done a very good job.
The confirmation about Mr. Fahour's outgoing pay does overshadow a strong profit for you after tax of $95 million. That's despite a $108 million loss on the letter business. But is Australia Post turning the business around to take on e-commerce competitors, especially in that lucrative parcels area?
You're probably right. I hope it does not overshadow a very good result. You know, with somebody like Amazon coming into the environment, we're looking forward to even further boost in online shopping and our e-commerce business.
Australia Post Chairman John Stanhope with the ABC's Senior Business Correspondent Peter Ryan. So how is news of this payout likely to play out publicly? If early indications are anything to go by, it's not sitting that well. And one expert says corporate Australia needs to get used to increased public scrutiny, especially around executive pay. Penny Timms reports.
What is the right amount for a see-you-later package when the company in question is owned by the Australian government? Well, out on the street, people the World Today spoke to generally felt that $10.8 million is a bit rich.
Yeah, I think so. I definitely think so. You don't really see what they do, so I mean, like, how do you know what they're being paid for?
Yeah, they do get paid a lot. I think the people below do a lot more work than what they're paid for.
That's also the thinking of Associate Professor Julie Walker of the University of Queensland. She's an Associate Professor of Accounting and has a special interest in corporate responsibility and executive remuneration.
Look, I think it's a very big number, isn't it, Penny? There's no denying that. It also includes a fair chunk of superannuation, which we perhaps should take out if we're discussing the actual quantum of his termination pay, because we don't normally include superannuation when we're talking about executive remuneration. It still is a very large number, nonetheless. It sits, you know, up on the high end, certainly, amongst corporate termination payments.
How do you think this is likely to be perceived in the public sphere?
Well, as usual, you know, the general public seem to be very outraged somewhat at the size of executive pay packets, and particularly when it's an organisation like Australia Post, which, you know, is not a publicly listed company.
And Associate Professor Walker says there is likely to be even further fallout to this latest news about Mr. Fahour's final package.
Look, I think there is. There's a lot of cynicism, I think, on the part of the public, particularly when we're talking about public enterprises such as Australia Post, because there's no public listing here. It's not a shareholder-owned organisation. The pay that the CEO is departing with is real money. It's not equity awards or options, which is a large chunk of corporate executive pay. So, I think there is reputational fallout from this type of thing where the executives are seen as, ripping off or extracting rents, as we'd say, from the organisation. concerned. I guess the question we need to ask is whether the public feels that that's good value.
Is it just a basic fact that we'll have to pay this sort of money in order to attract the right talent into these positions, or is this a bit of a different situation that we've got here?
Yeah, look, I think this is something of a blip. I think at the time, some months ago, there was some publicity about the CEO's pay packet, and comparisons were made to similar positions in overseas organisations in the same industry. The general consensus being that this is quite exceptional, this type of arrangement made for Australia Post.
And she feels that generally executive pay will fall relatively flat in the coming years as public scrutiny intensifies. Meanwhile, postal workers are understood to be upset by today's revelations. In a statement, the State Secretary of the Victorian branch of the Communication Workers Union, Leroy Lazaro, says it's obscene that Mr. Fahour is walking away with nearly $11 million as, quote, a payoff for slashing the postal services of all Australians. His statement goes on to say, our members will be receiving a less than CPI pay rise, absolutely outraged.
Penny Timms reporting. A Spanish court has ordered the release of one of the four suspects arrested over last week's terror attacks. The judge found there wasn't enough evidence to keep Sal Al-Kharib in custody. Two men are still in custody, another two have been freed, while eight suspects were killed in the hours after the attacks. Meanwhile, French police are trying to work out why some of the men made a whirlwind visit to Paris days before. Anne Barker reports.
A Spanish newspaper has posted CCTV vision on its website showing three of the men involved in last week's attacks in the hours before. They'd visited a petrol station four times on the same day to buy bread and omelettes and cigarette lighters. The ARA newspaper says the men were regular customers, but this would be the last time they made a visit. Within hours, they drove to Cambrils on the coast south of Barcelona, where in suicide belts they rammed a car into pedestrians and stabbed a woman who later died. All the attackers were killed in a shootout with police. Spanish authorities are gathering new leads on the 12 men who made up the terror cell. At Alcanar, 200 kilometres south of Barcelona, they've carried out a series of controlled detonations at a house where they found 120 gas canisters. They suspect the men were making explosives, but blew up the house by mistake, damaging other homes nearby. The police detonations are making residents jumpy.
Terrible.
It's terrible thinking about what could have happened if all the bottles had exploded at the same time, says this woman. We wouldn't be here. We arrived after the first big detonation, says another woman, but afterwards we've experienced two, a softer one and a harder one. At first we thought it was all starting again, but then they explained the police were carrying out explosions. As Spanish police piece together the men's final movements, French authorities are investigating why some of the suspects made a whirlwind trip to Paris in the days before, in the same car used in the attack at Cambrils. François Malin is a Paris prosecutor. The Audi A3 vehicle used by the terrorists during the attack of Cambrils was in France, specifically in Paris on 11 and 12 August, so the investigation is being led in close coordination with the Spanish judicial authorities to determine the reasons why this whirlwind trip took place and if the terrorists were in contact with other persons on our national territory. Mr. Molin says French police know where the men stayed, but want to know more about who they met. They came 2 days in the Paris region where they stayed in a hotel, where they went to certain places, and I won't say more about it. In Barcelona, a memorial service was held in honour of the 13 people killed when a separate vehicle ploughed into pedestrians along Las Ramblas. Meanwhile, funerals have begun for those killed in the attacks. In Italy, the funeral of a man who was one of those mowed down in Barcelona. Bruno Galotta was on holiday in Spain with his wife and two small children. They all survived. It's understood Spanish authorities have released the bodies of victims, including Australian boy Julian Cadman.
Anne Barker reporting. Well, staying with news on the global terror threat, ISIS has released a new propaganda video calling on Muslims from Southeast Asia to join the fight in the Philippines. The graphic film, which runs for nearly 7 minutes, attacks Australia, describing it as the regional guard dog of the USA. And the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, is warning that the city of Marawi could become the next Raqqa if action isn't taken. Stephanie Boris has more.
The images are disturbing, gruesome and upsetting. Dead bodies lying across the ground, militants setting fire to a church, stamping on statues, ripping up photos of the Pope. The latest ISIS video calls on Muslims from across Southeast Asia to join the battle in the southern Philippines. It also takes aim at the country's president, Rodrigo Duterte, for accepting help from Western nations.
Duterte ran to his masters, the defenders of the cross, America, along with their regional guard dog, Australia, and begged them for help. And despite having been previously insulted by Duterte, they were quick to put their differences aside, aiding him with a malicious air campaign with the hope of either achieving victory over the Islamic State or repelling its threat.
Greg Feely is the Associate Professor of Southeast Asian Politics at the Australian National University. He says the release of another propaganda video shouldn't come as a surprise, but it's interesting to note who they're targeting.
In this most recent video, they're referring explicitly to Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Singapore and Brunei, so that's quite specifically targeted.
Nations from across the globe have focused fighting ISIS in the Middle East, but the terror group has gained ground in the city of Marawi in the southern Philippines. Greg Feely explains why it's emerging as a key site for ISIS activity in Southeast Asia.
There is much less control in this island of Mindanao of the population, much less effective military and police control than what there is in most other parts of Southeast Asia. So, for example, in Indonesia and Malaysia, it would be almost impossible for a jihadist group such as we have in Marawi to have a jihadist group like that holding on to territory, being able to hold part of a major city, which is what's happening in the southern Philippines.
Hundreds of thousands of locals have fled the city since fighting began earlier this year. As a result of growing tension, the Philippines accepted Australia's offer in June to send two defence aircraft. They're providing surveillance support to the nation's armed forces. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull told Melbourne Radio 3AW Australia has a vested interest in assisting.
We do not want Marawi to become the, the Raqqa of Southeast Asia.
Greg Feely says that is a possibility, but he's warning nations to tread carefully in what assistance they provide.
I think we should be extremely wary about having a military contribution there because that can provide PR material for ISIS and make it seem as if this is now a struggle between the supposed Christian West and these pro-ISIS forces.
During a press conference, Mr. Turnbull was asked about the prospect of boots on the ground.
I don't speculate on hypotheticals. We're already providing assistance to the Philippines and we'll continue to provide the assistance that we currently have deployed.
The political situation in the Philippines is far from straightforward. President Duterte has been condemned across the globe for his inhumane war on drugs, which has killed thousands of people. It's a delicate balancing act. Western nations, including Australia, have called on the president to protect human rights, but at the same time they're working with him to try and stop ISIS gaining ground.
Stephanie Boris reporting. As many as 60% of Australian teenagers have seen racist material online, and about a third of them have been exposed to terrorist propaganda. Those findings from the federal government's eSafety Commissioner coincide with the launch of a new website to help young people deal with disturbing content on the internet. Samantha Donovan reports.
More than 2,000 Australians aged between 12 and 17 were surveyed about their experiences online. 60% said they had been exposed to hateful or racist content. Julie Inman-Grant is the National eSafety Commissioner.
Well, they've seen a lot of hate directed towards minority groups, including Muslims, refugees, asylum seekers and Indigenous Australians.
How are young people reacting to this sort of material when they come across it?
50% 7% of the young people that we spoke to said that they would take action in response to online hate and racism. And of course, we want to help young people do that in a way that's safe and positive. But then there's the other half of people who aren't doing anything, whether that's reporting the hate speech to the social media site or responding and standing up for a buddy or a person who might be the target of that hatred.
Was much of that material terrorist propaganda?
Our research showed that 30% of young people have seen some form of terrorist content online, and that's clearly an alarming statistic. Thankfully, the social media companies are getting better at identifying this content and taking it down. We also partner with Kids Helpline. So not only can the content be reported to the eSafety office, but we can put them in touch with emotional and mental well-being support staff should a child be traumatized.
Are internet filters not blocking that sort of material in homes or schools so children just don't come across things like videos of beheadings?
Well, exposure to inappropriate content is happening in a number of different ways. It could be pro-terrorist content, or it could be extreme pornography. And filters certainly do have a role in helping protect young people, but we can't have a set-and-forget mentality amongst adults. There is no substitute for parents being engaged in their kids' online lives and helping them navigate the net together.
The Office of the eSafety Commissioner is launching a website called Young and eSafe. It aims to help youngsters deal with the material they come across online. Julie Inman-Grant says the resource was largely developed by children.
So the stories are based on real anecdotes and real scenarios that have happened. We also know that for young people today, it needs to be engaging content, it needs to be authentic, and it needs to be a little bit edgy to grab their attention. So we've got short videos on there that are meant to be conversation starters so that young people can use experiential learning, ask questions, think about the scenario, problem solve for themselves so that they can hopefully apply those learnings to real-life situations as they encounter them online.
The eSafety Commissioner, Julie Inman-Grant, ending Samantha Donovan's report. On air through ABC Radio and Radio Australia, streaming live on our website and via the ABC Radio app, this is The World Today. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News. Well, just 3 years ago, the Australian airline Qantas was dealing with severe turbulence when it posted a $2.8 billion financial loss. This year, the turnaround for Qantas continues as it posted a healthy after-tax profit for the full year of $852 million. The ABC senior business correspondent Peter Ryan was at this morning's results briefing at Mascot in Sydney, and he joins me now. Peter, many airlines around the world are still struggling, so what's Qantas doing differently?
Well, Tom, on the surface, that $852 million profit looks good, but it is down by just over 17%. But this year, Qantas has been helped by the sale of its lease at Sydney's domestic airport. Qantas International, though, is still being challenged, but the group profit has been helped by more cost-cutting and a very strong domestic business. Now, while Alan Joyce is firmly in control at Qantas after some tough years, he now has some time to talk about non-aviation issues on the national agenda. So I asked Mr. Joyce about the $10.8 million payout Australia Post gave Ahmed Fahour. But first I asked Mr. Joyce about same-sex marriage, given that he's urging Australians to vote yes in the coming vote.
I fundamentally believe if you believe in a fair go for all Australians, you should vote yes. And if you believe in love and commitment, you should vote yes. And where else in the world would an openly gay Irishman become the CEO of the leading iconic brand?
Are you disappointed that this has become a very hot political debate that's quite divisive at the same time?
Yes, I think it has become divisive, and some of the material that we're seeing coming out is very hurtful. Hurtful to gay families, hurtful to children of gay parents, hurtful to the community. That worries me. I think that's why I've always said and always thought there should be a decision that should be done by Parliament, and I still believe that.
Have you had any backlash in the corporate sense about speaking publicly about this?
A lot of corporate leaders are very strong and supportive on this. I was even saying that Richard Branson, when he was down here, he's been a big supporter of LGBTI rights. He was hammering Qantas on everything under the son, but one thing he was actually promoting was our support for marriage equality, and he's been even more vocal in some ways on this.
Now, you're in a high-pressure job, and you've been rewarded for that, given what Qantas and you've been through over the last number of years. But today, the Australia Post chief executive, former chief executive Ahmed Fahour, Australia Post has revealed that he's going to be walking away with $10.8 million made of his base salary and long-term incentives over the years. But is that a fair salary for someone who's basically a corporatised public servant?
What I can say in our case is that our remuneration for the senior executives has always been based on the performance of Qantas. So when Qantas didn't perform well, nobody got bonuses.
Today, the Australia Post chairman, John Stanhope, has said that although there's nothing he could do about Ahmed Fahour's pay, he did concede that it didn't pass the community test or the pub test. Is that a fair enough thing, given that Ahmed Fahour turned the business around from a failing letters business to a parcels business?
All I can say is the relationship with Australian Post has been really strong. Ahmed's done a fantastic job at turning that business around.
Qantas Chief Executive Alan Joyce. Peter, how did investors react to the Qantas profit result?
Tom, they seem very relaxed at Alan Joyce's leadership at Qantas, so Qantas shares were up 3.3% in late morning trade.
The ABC's senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan, thank you. It's 75 years since the Kokoda track campaign, when Australian forces fought a series of battles in what was then the Australian territory of Papua. The 39th Battalion played a significant role in delaying the Japanese advancement along the Kokoda track, who were intent on seizing Port Moresby. 92-year-old Arthur Grasby from East Gippsland in Victoria was in the 39th Battalion and among the group that was the first to go over the Kokoda track to meet the Japanese forces. He's one of the Australian soldiers invited to a special service at the Shrine of Remembrance in Melbourne tomorrow to mark the anniversary and remember those who never came home. Melinda Ogden reports.
Arthur Grasby clearly remembers the Pacific War. He was a young, innocent country boy who technically should never have been sent to war.
I put my age up and I was only about 16 when I joined up originally. A lot of my friends had joined up and a lot of them had put their age up too, so I thought I'd do the same.
Mr Grasby was part of the Australian militia sent to New Guinea in 1942.
They expected the Japanese to land in Port Moresby, and we were barbed wiring all around the beaches, digging positions and everything.
In mid-July, Mr Grasby was part of the first contingent to go over the Kokoda track in anticipation of the arriving Japanese forces.
We heard this big guns going off and we thought it was must have been a naval battle. We were quite a few miles away and we found out after it was the Japanese shelling the beach at Buna. We were at Kokoda, that's about 2 days walk away, and we had to go and meet them, which was pretty crook. And anyway, there wasn't enough of us there to stop them.
Professor David Horner of the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the Australian National University says the 39th Battalion's role was to delay the Japanese.
Now, that holding up the Japanese is really crucial because that meant that the Japanese were using up supplies. And their advance was being delayed.
It wasn't a battle, really. It was just a bit of a fight, sort of, you know. We had to keep retreating because there wasn't enough of us until the battle for Kokoda. That was the main one. There was only one company of us there, about 100 odd, and the Japs had attacked during the night, and we couldn't stop them. There was too many of them. They had artillery and we had nothing like that at all. Only had machine guns and rifles.
Professor Horner again.
The Japanese had these light artillery pieces, and that was really one of the important things that gave the Japanese an advantage over the Australians who were fighting on the Kokoda Trail. The Australians didn't have any artillery at all.
We retreated back to that village called Deniki. Yeah, we went back to there. Another company, the battalion, come and reinforced us.
What happened then? You went back to retake Kokoda again, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
And how did that battle go?
No, couldn't hold it.
Mr. Grasby and his men rested for a few days before preparing for the Battle of Isharava on August 26th.
Yeah, that was a big battle. That's when the 2nd 14th Battalion AIF come up, and if they hadn't come up, we wouldn't have lasted another day. They overran us in the finish. A lot of casualties.
Battle-weary and weak with malaria, Mr. Grasby was taken to see a doctor.
He sent me back to Fort Moresby and I ended up in the hospital. I went to get into bed after they cut me clothes off, and stinking old clothes, and hadn't been washed for weeks. They examined me and found that I had a hunk of shrapnel in my shoulder. He said, hospital ship's in the harbour. He said, and I'll get you on it. That's how I come to come home.
You did pretty well, though, in all of those battles, Arthur, to survive them all. You must have been a pretty clever fighter.
I don't know about clever, but a bit lucky, I think. I was a pretty good shot with a rifle. I'd had experience with shooting rabbits and one thing or another.
The 39th Battalion was involved in further fighting during the Kokoda Campaign, and by early November 1942... the Japanese had retreated, allowing Australian forces to reclaim Kokoda.
Melinda Ogden reporting. Well, there's no doubt the Kokoda Track campaign is etched into the minds of many as one of the country's most significant and courageous feats of World War II. But at around the same time, in 1942, the Battle of Milne Bay marked a major turning point. The victory halted the advance of the Japanese towards Australia, and today marks the 75th anniversary of when that battle began. It also coincides with the launch of an exhibition at the Australian War Memorial commemorating the event. To discuss what happened in the battle and its broader significance, I spoke to Dr. Lachlan Grant, a senior historian at the War Memorial.
At Milne Bay, with the Japanese approaching towards Port Moresby on the Kokoda Trail, a Japanese landing force, Japanese Marines, with the support of two tanks, landed at Milne Bay trying to capture the Allied airfields that were being built in the area.
And what's the significance of Milne Bay itself in terms of its location? Can you elaborate more on why it was so important in the Pacific campaign?
The airfields at Milne Bay helped provide protection for that tip of the New Guinea Islands. So those airfields were really protecting those supply lines between Australia and America and New Zealand and the approaches to Port Moresby itself. So the Japanese were trying to cut off those airfields from the Allies' use.
Milne Bay is known for its swamplands and its high rainfall. Did the geography of the area prove to be an obstacle in that battle?
Oh, it was certainly some of the worst conditions in which Australians fought in the Second World War. In incessant rain, and we're not talking kind of rainfall we might be used to in Australia, tropical rain, over 3,000 millilitres a year at Milne Bay, and it rained almost constantly through the entire battle. Added to this was the heat, of course, the jungle, the plantations in which they are fighting, and the tropical disease was rife in the area. Malaria was endemic. Many of the troops were sick from tropical diseases. And a lot of the battle was actually fought at night time. So added into that, the heavy rain, the darkness of the jungle, the conditions of being fought at night, it was quite a terrifying experience for those Australian troops facing those two Japanese tanks.
And the Japanese forces were taken by surprise about the number of military personnel who were defending the area, weren't they? How many Allied troops were there?
The 2,800 Japanese troops that landed at Milne Bay faced a much larger force of Australians, which included some American engineers as well. And the Japanese thought there was only one airfield at Milne Bay, and there was actually three. And it's quite important because the airfields were being used by two Australian fighter squadrons, number 75 and number 76 squadron. And it was the role of the P-40 Kitty Hawks of the Royal Australian Air Force played a decisive role in the battle. They sunk many of the Japanese landing barges as they were making their way into Milne Bay, cut off the Japanese forces that were landing, and then were attacking the Japanese soldiers on the ground.
How many people died in the battle on both sides?
Well, of the 2,800 Japanese who landed, only 1,300 managed to make the evacuation days later on the 6th and 7th of September. Some 750 Japanese lay dead around the area, and others attempted to escape over the mountains across Toowoomba. And more than 160 Australians lost their lives in the battle, and 14 Americans were killed. And there was also 50 to 60 Papuans were also killed during the battle.
So looking at the legacy of the Battle of Milne Bay, how was this a turning point in the Pacific War?
Well, Milne Bay was one of the first decisive defeats on the ground in the Pacific War. 1942 was the darkest year of the Second World War. Much had gone wrong. Singapore had fallen to great shock. Darwin had been attacked. Sydney Harbour had been attacked. Japanese forces were encroaching on Australian territories in New Guinea, and many Australians that feared a Japanese invasion. So the turning the tide at Milne Bay was of great importance, and the captured equipment and Japanese equipment at Milne Bay provided the Allies with much information about the Japanese forces, about their approach to fighting in the jungles, and it gave the Australians and the Americans much confidence in their abilities for the task of fighting in the jungles in the Pacific.
1942, you've described it as a particularly dark year in World War II, and the Kokoda Track campaign came at around the same time. Did the Battle of Milne Bay have an impact on what ultimately happened there?
Oh, absolutely. Preventing the Japanese from capturing those airfields played an important role further on in the Kokoda battle. We often think of these battles in isolation, but they are, from the Japanese perspective, they are all part of one large campaign. And if the Japanese had have captured those airfields at Milne Bay, Port Moresby would have been in danger. And at the stage that the Battle of Milne Bay was taking place, the Japanese were 84 kilometres from Port Moresby. So Port Moresby was very much under threat at this time. So the victory at Milne Bay was a real turning point.
We often hear about the battle for Australia when we talk about this period in military history. Can you tell me more about why Australia was facing this threat of invasion?
Well, certainly Australia, for the war, had signed up to the British Imperial Defence Strategy, which focused on the defence of Singapore and the creation of Singapore as a major military base. Of course, with the fall of Singapore having taken place on the 15th of February in 1942, it a great shock to the world and to Australia. It left Australia very vulnerable, and Japanese forces swept through Indonesia and they landed in New Guinea. So Australia was very much isolated, and Australia's crack fighting units, the veteran units of the 2nd RAF, were still in North Africa and the Mediterranean when these battles happened, and were only returning to reinforce the militia troops who initially faced the Japanese in New Guinea. And it's in at Milne Bay where some of the veterans of places such as Tobruk joined sides with the militia for the first time.
Looking at the legacy of the Battle of Milne Bay, is it a conflict that's remembered and acknowledged in Papua New Guinea?
Yes, it is remembered in Papua New Guinea, and there's a group of legatees who are over there at the minute for the commemorations of the battle. But I think we should also remember, too, some of the other battles of 1942. Kokoda obviously gets a lot of attention in Australia, but another significant battle is Milne Bay, and another significant battle which Australians play a key role in is also El Alamein, which occurred in Egypt in October 1942, October-November, the second battle of El Alamein. The Australian 9th Division plays a key role there in one of the other major turning points of the war, but Kokoda often gets the most attention. But there's a number of key battles in which Australia take part during 1942.
As you say, battles such as the Battle of Milne Bay, they don't have the same level of recognition as other conflicts involving Australian soldiers, the Kokoda Track campaign being one. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think we've discussed this quite a bit amongst colleagues here, and I think essentially it comes down to a visual history of these battles. At Kokoda, you had Damien Parra, who made his Oscar award-winning documentary, Kokoda Frontline. The photographers were at Kokoda, the newspaper reporters were covering events at Kokoda. The landing at Milne Bay was something that happened suddenly, and it didn't have the same coverage of the war correspondents weren't there, the filmmakers weren't there, the official war artists weren't there. We have footage and photos of the battlefield in the days after the battle took place, but not of the actual battle itself, whereas Kokoda, we have that really strong and very iconic visual record of that battle.
Dr. Lachlan Grant, thanks for speaking to the world today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Lachlan Grant, a senior historian at the Australian War Memorial. Now to some good news for women who fear getting older. A study spanning two decades suggests Australian women aged between 50 and 70 are actually becoming happier. Barney Porter reports.
We've all heard of grumpy old men, but for women, it seems, like a good wine, Well, you just get better with age. Professor Cassandra Zirke is the director of the Women's Healthy Ageing Project with the University of Melbourne.
Well, what we found was, in looking at people reporting symptoms throughout this period of 20 years, was that they were reporting less depressive symptoms as they got older. So that was quite a positive finding.
Professor Zirke and a team of researchers have gleaned the results by taking a different approach.
Well, there's been studies before, of course, examining depression in women because it's just such an important thing to do. However, these have looked at depression in young people, depression in mid-age people, depression in older people. So we know a lot about depressive symptoms. This study allowed us to look at the very same women from their 40s all the way through to 70 years of age. So we can actually look at a people's journey through life.
But she says the research hasn't provided all the answers as to why women in younger age groups might experience more symptoms of depression or negative moods.
This is actually the next phase of the research that we're about to go into, which is to look at these same women and then look at what is the factors that are associated with these depressive symptoms. But there's a lot of lifetime change that occurs between midlife and late life. There's a menopausal transition, and we looked at that, and that certainly wasn't responsible for these changes. So we're thinking it's got to do a lot with lifestyle and those kind of factors.
She notes it's also the age women start to hit retirement, and in general they have fewer responsibilities and more me time.
We were very concerned about older age depression because, as you know, there's a lot of reports that in the older age group there's isolation, financial difficulties and a lot of things that would make you more likely to suffer from depression. And we were actually quite pleased to see that, in fact, the depressive symptoms were less.
And while there's clearly more research to be done, for the moment, Professor Zirke is happy to dwell on the positives. The findings of the study are published in the journal Maturitas.
And that report's from Barney Porter. Healthcare workers in Victoria are on the front line in the bid to fight family violence under a new program being rolled out across the state from today. Under the $10 million program, thousands of workers will be trained to better identify and support victims of family violence when they present at Victorian hospitals. It comes out of a recommendation from the state's Royal Commission into Family Violence. From Melbourne, Claire Slattery reports.
Melbourne woman Katie, who doesn't want to share her surname, has a long history of family violence. For years, she endured psychological, financial, emotional and physical abuse from her husband, the father of her child.
We were scared of him. The worst thing that happened was towards the end of the relationship when my son, he was three, stood between our legs looking up at his parents saying, "Dada, don't hurt Mama."
Katie has had plenty to do with the health system over the years, but has found many doctors and nurses unwilling or unable to help or address her abuse.
So my son has inherited and acquired disabilities, and so over the past 13 years we've seen approximately 40 paediatric clinicians, and the response has been very, very disappointing. Indeed, when my ex-husband threatened me during a visit with a paediatrician and our child was present in the room, she did nothing.
It's a problem that a new program being rolled out across Victoria from today is trying to address. Healthcare workers in the state's 88 public hospitals will be better trained to identify and support victims. The initiative was recommended by the Royal Commission into Family Violence. Professor Kelsey Hegarty is the chair of Family Violence Prevention at Melbourne's Royal Women's Hospital.
We know that health providers are often the first port of call for women experiencing family violence, and therefore that first response is extremely important, to be empathic, non-judgmental, to allow women to be able to go on a pathway of safety and healing enabled by the health provider.
The program is being expanded after successful trials at the Royal Women's and Bendigo Health. It will teach clinicians, nurses and midwives to spot the signs. Kelsey Hegarty says for 20% of women experiencing family violence, it begins around the time of pregnancy and birth.
Often women are presenting with mental health symptoms, so anxiety or depression symptoms, or simply not sleeping. Sometimes it's chronic pain. Sometimes it is that they've been recently separated, and it's very high prevalence in women who've been separated. Also, the health professional might notice something, say an antenatal care, a closely controlling partner.
The program will also help health workers to connect patients to support services. Kelsey Hegarty says it will contribute to a system-wide response.
The million-dollar question, how do we solve this wicked problem of ending it completely? This is actually early intervention where we're trying to identify it earlier in a trajectory of a woman's and children's lives. So what we're trying to do is assist them to safety and assist them in healing from the trauma. Is it going to stop it? No. This is part of the puzzle, but it's not the whole puzzle.
Katie is now a survivor advocate. She believes a healthcare worker could have made the difference for her and others like her.
And I truly believe today is going to make a change. If health professionals feel comfortable about talking about a taboo subject, and we've learnt to talk about all sorts of taboos in this society, then they will ask routinely, because if they don't ask, people like me won't tell.
That's victims advocate Katie ending Claire Slattery's report. And if you're in an abusive situation or know someone who is, call 1800 737 732. If it's an emergency, call 000. There's a push underway to save a one-of-a-kind mobile mental health service in far north Queensland. Health services that can go on the road provide critical support in rural and remote areas, where cattle stations can be larger geographically than Tasmania. But as Renee Clough reports, federal government funding for the service is about to run out.
For the past 3.5 years, psychologist Chris Jones has travelled across 69,000 square kilometres of grazing country in far north Queensland.
G'day.
Between knocking on homestead doors, he's driven 115,000 kilometres, had 3 shredded tyres, 13 punches, and plenty of close encounters with local wildlife. He's also saved lives.
John, when he rang back 6 months after I first made contact with him, his marriage was in trouble. His wife had left him, and it was just really dire straits for him. Bordering on suicidal ideation, but he's responded very well. The marriage is going well.
Drought and debt combined with extreme isolation has led to issues like marriage breakdowns, depression and substance abuse.
Banks will come in and sell them up. And that brings all sorts of guilt and shame and all sorts, other elements into that. And the resilience that they are very famous for works against them. It keeps them out of the mental health arena. And so people suffer. If you have an argument with your spouse and it becomes pretty horrible, what you do, go and talk to a cow.
Mr. Jones says getting on the road and talking to people as they go about their daily lives has built up the trust of his patients.
Back of trucks, kitchen tables, in meatworks, all sorts of things. It makes it much easier. I mean, their space. And when I get to open the gates, as I do if I go on a lick run with one of the graziers, that gives them a bit of breathing space. I go and open the gate, come back in, and we pick up the conversation.
Terri-Ann Cranwell from Ellendale Station near Inisley has seen firsthand the difference the service has made in her community.
We got the people who were coming in and bringing in their drugs and the alcohol, and I know that Chris has dealt with people, and I believe he's got them on the straight and narrow. And we need Chris for the accidents also, like young fellows go pig hunting at night. One fell out the back of a ute recently. So he's, not very good, had a lot of hospital time. So Chris goes and sees the family and talks to them.
She says Mr. Jones's work goes above and beyond the normal scope of a psychologist.
He was bringing out vouchers. He gave me a pile because I was giving him names of people to see. And I gave about $500 or $600 vouchers to a lady just before Christmas, and she had 3 children, and she started to cry. And she had this little boy, he would have been 7. And he said, "Why are you crying, Mum?" And she said, "This nice lady has just given me money so we can have a Christmas." "Oh boy, Mum, can we now afford a bottle of cordial?" That cracked me up.
But now the service is under threat, with federal government funding ending next month. Chris Jones.
What I'm doing to safeguard my care for those people, if the crowdfunding thing doesn't happen and this thing stops, I'm offering pro bono services to people out there if they want to come to Cairns, and they even know they come down and see me from time to time.
How much do you need to keep this going?
Well, for my patch, I need about $200,000. So that's for a 12-month period. More broadly, who knows? We're taking that to a larger audience, hence the national focus. We're not quite sure how that's going to work out yet, but that's our goal.
The Primary Health Network says it's moving to a new model of mental health care to better service the need in such areas. And Mr. Jones has been informed so he can submit a tender.
He's done a heck of a good job, and if I had the funding, I'd keep him going myself.
Terry Ann Cranwell from Ellendale Station, ending that report from Renee Clough. And if you or anyone you know need help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. In many respects, it's quite literally uncharted territory. The vast frozen expanses of the Arctic Sea above Russia, Canada and Scandinavia. But as the world's climate changes, the Arctic itself is becoming much more accessible, suggesting the prospect of a new, faster sea lane between Europe and Asia. Now a Russian tanker carrying liquefied natural gas has docked in Korea, making the journey from Europe in 30% less time than the conventional route through Singapore and the Suez Canal. Stephen Smiley reports.
Docked in the harbour of the South Korean city of Boryong, the Christophe de Margerie tanker is a long way from its home port in Russia, carrying liquefied natural gas extracted off the coast of Hammerfest in Norway. The tanker was built especially to make the most of melting polar ice caps in the Arctic Sea.
The first time that a vessel has been able to go through without a separate icebreaker breaking the ice in front of it.
David Leary is an associate professor of law at the University of Technology in Sydney.
The Russians are looking at building a number of these vessels, and this is about opening up the waterways in the Arctic to transport the oil and gas that comes out of the Arctic region.
The attempt to find a passage through the Arctic to East Asia powered the European exploration of North America for centuries. While the fabled Northwest Passage proved elusive for explorers, changing climate has now made the sea lane a reality.
We've seen a number of Chinese vessels that have already passed through. This is something that's happening now. It's not something into the future. And as the sea lanes become more accessible with the melting of the Arctic, we're only going to see this increase.
Traditionally, long-haul cargo ships between East Asia and Europe travel via the Suez Canal. Dr. David Leary says the risk with greater volumes of trade using the Arctic route is that if something goes wrong, help will be much further away.
So the issue there relates to how you would actually go about cleaning up any oil spill in the Arctic, and also the capacity of countries in the region to rapidly respond both to an environmental hazard and also to any potential risk to the humans sailing on board these ships. You're talking about such vast areas of ocean space that are so isolated. How do you rescue people?
Climate scientist Caitlin Norton at the University of New South Wales says the Arctic Sea is melting much quicker than the models had predicted.
Sea ice is a very difficult thing to model. Most of them show a much slower melt than observations. Sea ice doesn't cause sea level rise because it's already floating. However, when the sea ice melts, that exposes a fair bit of the ocean surface to the sun, and the ocean surface is a lot darker than the sea ice, and so it absorbs a lot more of the sun. And in the Arctic in the summer, there's sun 24 hours a day. So there's a bit of a positive feedback that there, where the sea ice goes away, the ocean can absorb more sun, the ocean warms, then the sea ice melts faster, and so on.
Senior lecturer at the Climate Change Research Centre, Alex Sengupta, says the fact the Arctic sea ice models haven't been all that accurate has implications for the global climate too.
We have an amplifying effect of global warming, essentially, because of the melting of the sea ice. This is going to change the rate at which global warming is occurring. It also has direct effect on sort of weather patterns and things, but primarily in the northern hemisphere. So there's a lot of work being done on how the change in ice around the Arctic can affect the jet stream and affect, you know, cold periods and warm periods around Europe and North America. As we learn more about the Arctic, we can improve our climate models. We can put in better representations of how the sea ice works, and that's going to give us better forecasts of what might happen to temperatures over Australia in the future as well.
Senior lecturer at the Climate Change Research Centre, Alex Sengupta, ending that report by Stephen Smiley. And that's all from the World Today team for this week. I'm Thomas Ariti. The program's executive producer is Michael Edwards. The associate producer is Barney Porter, and research by Connie Agius. Technical production by Alan Arthur and David Lawford. Digital production by Laura Briley-Newton and Tom Joyner. And web publishing by Vanessa Bartel and Sandra Orprince. We'll be back at the same time on Monday. Have a lovely weekend.